great pleasure for me to introduce Helen, because I've also known her for a very long time as a former colleague in prison before I moved here. We done a book together, and without Helen's collaboration on that book, it would never have happened. She was the most wonderful colleague to work with, and Helen is also someone I value enormously as a friend. So when Peter Carroll sent me an email and said, "Oh, what do I think about Helen Graham being the next Bill Salzman lecturer?" I wrote back a very excited yes immediately, and we're delighted to have Helen with us today. Helen has done the most wonderful research on Spanish history in the 20th century, particularly the work that she's done on the Spanish Civil War. Many of you, I'm sure, will know her most recent book, which is the book on the Spanish Civil War. That's its title, in Oxford University Press's very short introduction series. That's a book which I tell all my students is the first thing they should read on the Spanish Civil War, and if they don't need anything else, they've got to read that book. It's an absolutely wonderful book, and particularly personally like the way she framed that narrative with stories of two different women at the beginning and end, which is not something that has been done before. That book's been translated into Spanish, Portuguese, German, and Greek, and in English alone it's sold over 28,000 copies, which we would all like to have happen to our books, but it doesn't happen to most of us. It does happen to Helen. She's also written an excellent book, The Spanish Republic at War, Cambridge University Press, 2002, with a Spanish translation, Socialism and War, The Spanish Socialist Party in Power and Crisis, Cambridge University Press, 1991, with a Spanish translation. She has several edited volumes, one of which has been translated into Japanese, but she has a truly international reach. I echo Peter's sentiments. I know you'll enjoy Helen's lecture. What I most value about her work is that everything she writes and says is done with passion. So, great welcome to you, Helen, and we're very happy to have you here.
I already know what I looked at. I thought I should begin by thanking Alba Valp and the King Juan Carlos Center for inviting me to dinner for this 10th in the series of the Bill Susan anniversary memorial lectures. So, thank you to all of those concerned. I'll have some visuals. I mean, I call this border crossings. I mean, I realised when I first put this up, I mean, it's a standard PowerPoint kind of template. For those of you who know your PowerPoint, it just took me how very Antonio Machado-esque it was when I put it up, that, you know, Caminante no hay camino, sort of traveller, there are no roads, you make the road when you walk, there are no roads, just a wake on the thing. And in a sense, that's very fitting, sort of kind of fitting beginning to some of the things that I want to say about exile and border crossing. I think my first, this is a kind of leitmotif for what I'm going to try and say today. It's a famous, well, quite a famous Robert Papa photograph, I don't know if people have seen it before. It's a group of international brigaders en route to San Ciprián internment camp. Be one of many, could be San Ciprián, Algelaine, Arcachon, those that line the French beaches. On Rupert, I think there's quotes on it. I don't know if people can, it seemed very nasty to put it in white, it might not have been such a good idea now, but anyway, I can read it. What has become of that 19th century universe when we paid in through and crossed every frontier where we liked and as we liked? And that's, I'll come back to who's the quote is and what it might mean later on, but in the sense it's a kind of leitmotif for everything I want to say today. The point is the title of Border Crossings, speaking about the international brigades before and after Spain, is I want to offer some thoughts, suggestions about how we might look at and frame the broader social and cultural history of the international brigaders. I'm not going to provide any kind of systematic macro-historical survey of the history of the brigaders. I'm not going to say that much about the Abraham Lincoln brigaders because there are plenty of people in this room who know more about this than I do. I mean, it's good to get one's disclaimers in at the beginning of the paper. What this paper is about, impressionistically I suppose, they suffered, those who survived the Spanish battlefields frequently suffered for it in consequence after the battlefields of Spain. And what they were either consciously or unconsciously about, it seems to me, the Crusaders were crossing lines, crossing borders, which I think is as good a definition as we can ever get of what social change is and how it actually happens, people crossing lines. The Crusaders, in a sense, they refused, they destabilised, they complicated what were supposedly fixed categories, homogenous categories of identity, whether they were national, racial, cultural, sexual, and that inexorably and for all time links them to radical forms of social change. So that's what I'm going to try and talk about. I want to talk about three interrelated, well, two or three things. First of all, I want to do the kind of least impressionistic thing, which is to locate the history of the Brigades where it belongs, but where it's very infrequently found in the history, and that is in the context of European diaspora, European exile. Then I'm going to say something about the reductive establishment and state narratives which, after the Civil War, shaped public and collective memory of the Brigades, both in the West and the East. Because the thing about being a line crosser is that you never fit. You'll never fit in any kind of state narrative. Whatever that state is, wherever it is, you'll always be somehow at odds with it. So I think this is what I hope to show in various exemplary ways. Anyway, and I'm also going to say a bit about some of the kind of psychological, psychic, social impact of Spain and its Republican defence and defeat on the lives of individual Brigaders. What I suppose the novelist Henry James talked about, the back of the picture, which seems to be often so often forgotten in the kind of high personalities, which is really important. Anyway, first of all, what do I mean by the Brigaders and European diaspora? Well, amongst the approximate 35,000 people, volunteers who fought for the Spanish Republic against Franco and his fascist backers, there were, of course, volunteers from all over the world. But most had their origins in Europe, even from the two North American contingents in the USA and Canada. The great majority of those people were either European migrants or they were the children of European migrants. So it is really a European story. Also, we can say that a very high proportion of those European migrants were already political exiles. Not only the obvious ones, the Germans, the Italians, and Austrians, but also those from other European countries dominated by right-wing dictatorships, autocratic monarchies, or the radical fascist right, Hungary, Yugoslavia, Romania, Poland, Finland. The Brigaders, if you like, were part of a mass migration of people, mainly from the urban working classes of those times, who had already left their countries of birth at some point after the First World War, sometimes before it, and almost for some mix of political repression, economic marginalisation, frequently both. Among the Canadian volunteers, for example, I mean, this is in the little book, I talk about the Finn when he goes fighting. Spain talks about he's going to avenge his sister who had been killed by the whites in the Finnish Civil War. That's an example that's in the book. Or all of those radical, restless refugee boys from the towns and villages of what was the Austro-Hungarian Empire, but when they fetched up to fight against Franco's nationalists, the rebels in Spain, they were also trying to get even with all of those narrow-minded good citizens of the towns and villages of Austro-Hungary who had kind of humiliated them and marginalised them as they drilled the proto-nationalist troops on the village square. So in a sense, this is a European story. It's not just about Spain. In fighting fascism in Spain, all of these exiles and migrants were explicitly taking up unfinished business that went back at least as far as the Great War of 1914-18, sometimes further back. The implications that war had produced had given rise to the birth of anti-democratic nationalisms, which had physically displaced them. And the whole kind of left internationalist politics, which these groups of people usually espouse, fitted very well with their exile condition. And it was almost perceived as a corrective, as an antidote to the vicious, literally murderous forms of proto-fascist politics which were inhabiting their own countries. In a sense, what I'm doing with the IPs in this image and this quote is identifying them with an earlier 19th century, the quote that mentions the 19th century, an earlier 19th century age, if you like, the ghosts of the revolution of 1848. After 1848, the national idea in Europe was increasingly co-opted rejected by outright conservative state builders. But the a tradition of travelling, hopefully, of bearing change across the borders lives on, and it lives on, it seems to me, into the 20th century in the international brigades. I mean, we can see this tradition of a border or line crossing, that potential for that, I think, most most explicitly in terms of the way they represent social change related to race, gender, and sexuality. I mean, a radical poet of the 1930s who, in fact, didn't actually fight in Spain, but he said, "No, I am an exile from a future time." And it seems often to me that that's a perfect way of describing what the international brigades were. But in terms of their own times, 1918-1945 period, or indeed just thereafter, the times were running against them because the world was closing down. It was closing down ethnically, culturally, and nationally during that period. And for that reason, they always remain outsiders. That may seem a bit impressionistic, what I've just said there, but I'm hoping that to kind of illustrate what I mean in the course of the talk. But in a nutshell, that's basically what I mean by the international brigades of European diaspora, that they are part of that movement of European exile and unfinished business that goes back to the Great War, or indeed to before the Great War. And you can't understand, it's not just a Stalin, no, I mean, it's part of a much broader European picture. As everybody here will obviously know, the political stakes were raised, the ones I described were raised further in the 1930s because of economic depression. I'm not going to labour this story because everybody knows it. Mass unemployment, deprivation, particularly in urban areas, accelerated process of political polarisation, and in a sense these people who came to Spain were the soldiers in that political war. One thing it might be important to say a bit about is the fact that these were new times, but they also saw the birth of new forms of politics. One thing, a bit of an aside, but I think it's worth saying, because in Spain, what the 1930s brought was this huge explosion of youth, of young people, into politics in a way that had never been seen before. This is also a way of showing you some of my favourite photographs. This is in 1934, this is Manuel Carmen Barra on the beach in Madrid. Well, obviously Madrid doesn't have a beach, it must be some, I'm not quite sure exactly. It's called La Playa de Madrid, I'm not sure where it might be being. In 1934, I love this picture because, in a sense, in just a single image, you see everything the Franco would have done, that kind of ease of corporality. I mean, it's a very modern picture, you know, in a sense. Fernando La Corte was a radical student, he was a doctor, trying to be a doctor. He was one of the kind of vanguard political activists in Republican youth. He, at the age of 24, the emperor was commanding one of the major units of the Republican army. Thereafter, of course, he had to go into exile. He died very early in his late 50s in Mexico in 1971. Anyway, the point being, he's 25 and he's in charge of a core of the Republican Army. I mean, I say this to my students, you know, he's not younger than you. And even when you think about the guys and the women who defended Madrid, the Defense Council of November 1936, when all the government shifts off to Valencia, their average age, I've told you this. If you take out the way Niafa, who was a kind of pretty useless titular head of the Defense Council, take him away, because he looks about 68, he's only about 58. You take his age out of it, their average age was about 23 and a half. I mean, this was an unbelievable, and for Franco wiped this whole generation of political activists out in 1939-1940. You look at the people who were shot in the Madrid prisons, they're all of these people go down after the aftermath of the Casado coup in 1939. So, I mean, this is a huge experiment. There's a huge explosion of youth into the political scene. That's just a picture. And it's not the university city, of course, where there was hand-to-hand combat fighting in the Civil War on the western edge of Madrid. That's the new university buildings, which were this is the group of Republican university student activists, but again, it's like you young people. I like that picture because it's not the classic pictures of kind of people marching in the streets, but it was a kind of an intellectual and a social and cultural mobilisation as well as a political mobilisation. These international brigaders, some of them were very young too. Here is my favourite, my favourite international brigader. This is Bill Alto. Finnish American boy from the Bronx. Of whom we're in love. Bill Alto was 20-something when he went to fight with the International Brigades, and he ended up fighting as a guerrilla behind the lines, about which more we're in love. He was 27. Obviously, we all know from the books that there are other brigades, that the average age was near 27. There were brigades in the 19, there were brigades that were 50-something, but the average age was kind of late 20s. Too young for most of them to have fought in the Great War. Most of the international brigades didn't have, even Europeans, didn't actually have hands-on military experience that they were acknowledging. But they did have, they were able to have been involved in the street fighting of the post-First World War years that I've just described, kind of revolutionary street fighting. So they, obviously when they go to Spain, they know that they go with the self-conscious knowledge that they are political soldiers in an ongoing European Civil War. They're not only soldiers in a political war, they're also soldiers in a culture war for this European war, this European Civil War, like Spain's own, was a culture war. What General Franco and his rebel forces were seeking to do was really quite breathtaking. He was seeking, in a sense, to court-martial social change. I mean, that, if you think about it, with the military now. When his army of Africa lands from Spanish North Africa in the late summer of 1936, sweeped up through the south of Spain, wiping out agricultural laborers and villages, entire villages sometimes. But they sweep up through a deep south en route from Madrid. Really, and at the same time, all over the rest of rebel-held territory, Civilian vigilantes are kind of disappearing their fellow citizens in the dead of night in a kind of dirty war. Well, what's going on here? Well, really, they are literally killing change, right? They are targeting people, right? They're targeting political leaders, trade union officials, they're targeting people with political responsibilities. But they're not just doing that. It's cleansing. This is the effort that went on. Was against the targets of people who carried with them, if you like, symbolize social and cultural change too. We symbolize a challenge to older ways of being and thinking. So, you know, they were killing progressive teachers, they were killing intellectuals, self-educated workers, and new women. There are some examples in the book. This is a famous one. Amparo Marañón was the wife of a famous Republican novelist, but in fact, she was killed, it seems to me, because she's a cloche-hatted 20s girl who was one of the first women who went to work for Telefonica in the Georgia left, the provincial backwater of Leon, and goes, so at the end she goes back to Leon in the first weeks of the war, and part of what she's killed for, it seems to me, is being, having ideas. You know, so many people died in that kind of dirty war at the beginning of the Civil War. Basically, because they kind of were challenging kind of this accepted social order. I can't really stress enough here how much challenge the Republic posed to social deference and established social order. The language of rights, which is allowed to be spoken, how that generated the level of murderous rage which that generated it amongst not just petition elite conservatives, but also, you know, a lot of God-fearing ordinary Catholics. I mean, there was a tremendous amount of channeling violence against people who bore within them social change. And I think that's not a digression, because in a sense, what I'm saying is that the international communities also carried that change. The violence that was being unleashed across Europe, not just in Spain, also derived from the same kind of acute clashes between, you know, rural against urban, tradition against modernity, fixed social hierarchies against more fluid egalitarian modes of politics. Those tensions which erupted in Spain were, in a sense, colouring the politics of a whole continent. And lots of politicians and political leaders all over the place were trying to close down political and social change in the same way as Francisco Franco did. I mean, Franco's idea was to basically to manage social change in a fairly brutal way, to create a kind of very rigid national community, which was, in a sense, his own version of the Volksgemeinschaft. I mean, it was very like what Hitler created in Germany. I mean, Franco wasn't a piece of the Second World War, which is what dismantled the German Volksgemeinschaft. So, I hope it's not too confusing, but I'm trying to draw the links all the time between what's going on between the European So many of the European regimes which the Brigade of Exiles had fled after 1918 were busy developing forms of politics which were based on ethnic segregation and purification. Why did the Nazis have so many collaborators? Because it actually gelled with all sorts of national agendas throughout Europe. And this policy of segregation, purification was aimed at both racial and other sources of social minority. And the seminal work on this is a book by a guy called Lazaro, who indeed is now Columbia via London University. But Dark Continents, Europe's 20th Century, that's the kind of key text here. In the traditional rural dominated societies that there were normally in Eastern and some parts of Central Europe, all of these minorities obviously included the urban left, but obviously not in Germany itself, because the urban left in Germany, the labor movement, was a huge social force. But in other more sort of easterly rural societies, they were minorities. Even in Germany, as well as the opening of the first German concentration camp set up in 1933 with the sort of Reich Security Act, they also incarcerated and persecuted German outsiders, the different, the marginal, the hybrid, the heterodox, in whatever sense, you know, politically, socially, culturally, sexually. The kind of hybridity that Hitler was on a mission to annihilate. And the German international brigaders took to saying at least one song, it's quite famous, the Beatbox Soldiers and the Soldaten, one song that was actually written by two of the those who were incarcerated in the first, the early German Nazi concentration camps. These first camps in Nazi Germany didn't especially target Jews as Jews, although many Jewish people were nevertheless amongst those who were incarcerated. And once they were confined, their treatment was always amongst the worst. So there were so many Jewish volunteers in the international brigades, about a quarter of the total, is of course unsurprising. But it's unsurprising if you consider two factors. One, the long history of anti-Semitism within the European continent and the way in which it was directly shaping these purificatory and social Darwinist politics of the European right after 1918, which is also manifesting itself in Spain, of course, which of course has no indigenous Jewish population. It has a migrant refugee population of European Jews, but doesn't have many Jews as members of the kingdom, obviously 1492 and all of that, the first totalitarian monarchy, you know. But of course, the Spanish rights discourse was very anti-Semitic. You know, the absence of Jews was an equivalent to that. If you think about the Judeo-Masonic Bolshevik conspiracy, which is of course Franco's staple firm, anti-Semitism is crucial in the conspiracy against eternal Christian Spain. So again, Spain is part of this bigger picture. So that's one reason, that kind of anti-Semitic tradition, one reason why you'd not be surprised to find high representation of Jewish people in the brigades. But also you have to compute the long-standing and very strong radical political tradition amongst Jewish migrant communities who fled the pogroms and endemic discrimination of Europe, of Russia and East Europe, such as indeed was the case of Bill Susan's own family members, of which including his own father and mother, and made the journey from Russia to Connecticut. And amongst the Polish brigades too, in Spain, there's a very high proportion of Jewish people. A specifically Jewish company was formed in the Polish battalion, which attracted an international membership, all sorts of people. It was named after a young Jewish communist who had been killed in Poland in 1925, a Nastali Botwin. And that kind of tradition, the members of this company would fight alongside very many other international brigade veterans in the French resistance and in many of the other partisan conflicts, in Yugoslavia, for example, that comprised the European civil wars of the period 1939 to 1945, 1947. Those kind of dense internal conflicts which were all fought out under the kind of overarching carapace of the kind of Second World War, but which were about all of these settling of scores and determining of social and political order inside individual European states. A lot of Jewish brigades fought in that specifically Jewish company, but many, even very many more fought outside it, maybe because they thought that, well, I think clearly the case, they saw that anti-fascism was much more important mark of personal identity than their Jewishness. And I think the French Jewishness is perhaps better in that context defined as sort of Yiddish cultural identity, because that fits better with their secular internationalism, which was an integral part of values of most of these Jewish brigaders. Zionism, of course, was far too close to the other forms of nationalism that they eschewed as part of the original European segregationist political malaise. And they were sort of Yiddish secular internationalists, if you like, and therefore thought as anti-fascists rather than as Jews. I would say, though, just before we move on, that there were plenty of international brigaders who, as individuals, were anti-Semitic and racist, or otherwise nationally chauvinist. There's quite a bit of work going on about kind of conflict inside the international brigades. I don't actually think that fact getting phrased is my interpretation of what the international brigaders as a whole signified, although maybe that's one for us to discuss when we talk about things. But what I'm trying to say is that the living existence of the international brigades, what they signified racially and culturally, made them a kind of living form of opposition to the principles of purification that fascism actually espoused. And they didn't have to be coherent or contradictory. They were it because they were multiracial and multinational. And it wasn't just really about doing battle with European sequence, of course. The Abraham Lincoln Brigade, in which about 90 African Americans fought, was, as I guess many people here already know, the first non-segregated American military unit ever to exist, as the US Army went on operating segregation throughout the Second World War. So, even through that optic, what, in a sense, the brigade signifies a certain spirit of future possibility, I have an exile for a future time. They were, then, very imperfectly and by no means fully consciously, but nevertheless they were, in some ways, they were the soldiers of some kind of cosmopolitan cultural modernity. Social change in action. In some ways, that was the sort of idea I was trying to convert, I don't know whether I did so successfully, in the little book on the Civil War, when I cite an extract from a really kind of very big selling book by Spanish novelist called Javier Fercas, Soldiers of Salamis, Soldados de Salamina, which discusses in the book, and it's a very medieval book, but I think because its work is based on the shelf for what I'm about to relate, he discusses the role of a group of politically and racially very diverse soldiers who fought in the Allied ranks, in the ranks of the Wall Street French in North Africa. They were all sorts of people. They were exiled Spanish Republicans, assorted veterans, international brigade veterans, European anti-fascist exiles of various kinds, from the forced labour brigades, from the concentration camps of Vichy, France, racially diverse ex-members of the French Foreign Legion, who all come together in this attack on an Italian outpost in southwest Libya in January 1941. It's a real event, although he kind of constructs this fictional story around it. And somebody in Fercas's book remarks, he says, just imagine. And Fercas's narrator continues, if the speaker was himself discovering the story as he related, just imagine all of Europe controlled by the Nazis in the middle of nowhere without anyone knowing it. There they damn well were. Four North Africans, a black guy, and an old customer Spaniard raising liberty flag for the first time in months. And the idea is, in that telling of the story in that way, the multi-ethnic and cosmopolitan composition of the three French forces becomes the meaning of the Second World War. Those who plant the Allied flag in this remote part of Libya are Hitler and Franco's mongrel soldiers, right, who save Europe from fascism's idealization of racial purity and martial virtues, I mean, and the antidote, the antithesis. And this same sort of hybridity and difference is played out in the resistance movements in Europe, for example, in France. I think now quite well known that the French resistance was for people who weren't French. That is to say, for example, the urban-based resistance movement, the MOI, which is the acronym MOI itself means the Migrant Labour Front, was another kind of like these group of fighters in North Africa. They were the absolute antithesis of Hitler's New Order. So many people in the MOI start out in the prison, you know, the prison camps of France, and particularly in a camp called GURS, where there were lots of international brigade veterans. As well as French and Spanish Republican fighters, the MOI included Italians, Romanians, Albanians, Poles, Austrians, Czechs, Hungarians. Again, like the brigades themselves, probably half of the MOI were, or the MOI were, Morocco under great pressure in the Third International Brigade of Veterans, as well as French and Spanish Republican fighters, the Moi included Italians, Romanians, Armenians, Poles, Austrians, Czechs, Hungarians. Again, like the brigades themselves, probably half of the MOI were Jewish, and that put them under great pressure in the open resistance movement. They were on the wanted list three times over as foreigners, as Nazis, and as Jews, right? In February 1944, in Paris, the occupying forces, the Nazi brothers, executed 23 MOI fighters from a group led by the Armenian poet Misak Manouchian. Amongst the brigaders, sorry, amongst the executed were several international brigaders. The basic idea. This was the poster that the occupying forces plastered all over Paris walls. Liberation by the army of crime. And so you get the pictures of some of the 23 executed MOI members of the Manouchian group. And you can see, I often wonder how one of the feasible historical projects actually trace the lives of the people who appear on this poster. I think that would be a kind of restitution. But when the Nazis plastered this poster all over the walls in Paris, what they were clearly trying to do was legitimize the resistance through an appeal to French chauvinism. They're not French, right? And although we might like to say, and of course we read it differently as a memorial, well, we do, but let's not make any mistake, that would have had a tremendous resonance in France. It would have done. Because the Nazis' war against hybridity wasn't waged against the European grain. Hitler planned that idea, but the idea of ethnic homogeneity equaling political coherence, equaling psychological health and integrity, was an idea that was shared by very many people in European countries, east, south, north, and west. Indeed, the myth of the ethnically homogeneous European nation state, it seems to me, you can only furly and squirrely at the door of the Western peacemakers in 1918-1919, because the subliminal message of the League of Nations, of having to deal with all those pesky minorities and having to have all of these structures which don't really work to try and kind of protect them and make sure everything's all right, is the subliminal message of that, of course, is these people are the problem. And even in spite of the Western European, the Western all of this retrospective mythologizing of its what did the Western world signify? It was opposition to Hitler, opposition to the camp universe. In fact, that self-same post-1945 Western order has, as its almost foundational act, the massive convulsion of the European continent, which occurs between 1944 and 1948, which is ethnic cleansing, rebranded as population transfer. That is to say, the huge flux of Germans at various points, basically ahead of the Red Army between 1944 and 1945, and then out of all of the new post-liberation regimes in Czechoslovakia, Poland, Jamaica, this mass expulsion of people, and also as part an integral part of the social revolutions in Russia and East Europe, affected 12 million Germans, Poles, Ukrainians, all sorts of people. This, of course, was limited on East Europe, but I think that the origins of that toxic myth lie in Western Europe and lie in the notion of the coherent nation state. Frankly, the French Communist Party in 1944 understood this very clearly. It understood the currency of that poster, and in the bid to build a national coalition around the resistance, it played up the anti-fascism of the resistance, but it played down its multi-ethnic composition. French resistance could literally not be represented as Armenian Jews and Spanish guerrilleros. It's absolutely represented as French, uniquely homogenous as French. Questions of race and ethnicity within Europe are ever present when we're discussing the ramifications of the brigades in Spain. But these ideas also have resonance in other geographical contexts. The defense of the Spanish Republic was a major magnet for very diverse writers and fighters, thinkers, activists, revolutionaries, who were linked by a common desire to work towards the breaking down of brutal hierarchies wherever they were found. For example, the Indian writer and social critic Mohan Rajan was a close friend of Nehru's, who wrote the classic novel, wrote the classic anti-caste novel, The Untouchable. immediately recognised his own cause in the defence of Republican Spain, which he publicly supported and visited in 1937, and obviously raised for very clear reasons through the ongoing border crossing amongst North American brigaders as well. The Black England Brigader, Eleanor Michelle McDaniel, sailing home from active service in 1941 on leave in Durban, South Africa, who leads his fellow sailors in a sit-down protest at the Woolworths segregated lunch counter. Or another example, Lord Gough, who had fought with Gilalfo in the Spanish, he was two or three Americans in the guerrilla. That's Lord Gough on the right, that's Gilalfo again on the left. The other guys, we don't know who they are, one was a Spanish in Lasse, and another international trader, both of them were killed in action. Lord Gough in the late 1940s was a, if you like, a freedom rider. Before freedom riders had in a sense been invented, when an American Communist Party organizer in the South, he violated the laws of Louisiana by arranging racially mixed political meetings during the presidential campaign of 1948. And again, as Communist Party district organizer in New Orleans, he worked to encourage Black voter registration, jeopardizing his life on more than one occasion by ignoring Southern racial customs. And of course, Gough was a highly disciplined party operative. But that's not the whole story of this line crossing. I think it goes back to Spain. It's intrinsically tied up with the experience of Spain. I think the perfect illustration of how it is in this line crossing also involves Lord Gough and his former Republican guerrilla colleague, Bill Gilalfo. Gilalfo, the working class Spanish American boy from the Bronx, the tough, intelligent streetwise kid who becomes the guerrilla captain, who comes out of Spain in the 1939 with the highest commendation of any awarded by Comintern, Communist International authorities, to any Lincoln Brigader. Those of you who know Peter Carroll's book on Lidcock, the Odyssey of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, he just has this picture, which is supposedly Gilalfo. That's Gilalfo, that is the picture I showed you before. That is the same person as that, and that's an early Gilalfo. But also thin, and in fact he was a Finnish gorilla. Lots of fins in the gorilla, because they were sort of sturdy, hardy, well that was what I were, but it was also the idea of that. I'm not trying to go into the physiognomy now, but if you kind of squint at it, you can really see it's one and not the other, the shape of the nose, the shape of the cheeks, the lack of strong in the cheekbones, everything. It's dirty Alto. There you go. Anyway, but Bill Alto, this is the guy who is Gough's. Dirty was a gorilla, but he wasn't in the same team as Gough, which Bill Alto was. So Bill Alto is this this Republican war hero. Actually probably one of the models for Robert Jordan in any ways the Baltimore's, whether you think that's a recommendation or not, but he probably was. Anyway, this is a story about Gough and Alto and border crossing, right? Gough and Alto are on an agitprop tour of college campuses, going around the Northeast and the Upper Midwest, speaking on behalf of Republican Spain, Republican prisoners and refugees in 1940 when they come back from Spain. And during the tour, one day while they're parked in a car waiting driver on or near Ohio State campus, Bill suddenly tells Lord Gough that he's gay. Now, you should tell Gough that you should have really close bond from the war, they had a near-death experience in the aftermath of a very famous jailbreak, which they were both involved in May 1938 in the south of Spain. They became friends, they shared a life in political activism. But that doesn't seem very surprising to an audience in 2008 that should have happened. But remember, that was 1940. It's not the 1920s, it's nearly 30 years before Stonewall. And although Bill was okay about being gay, it was illegal. So it made him vulnerable. And you think, well, why did he do it? What was this revelation about? It has to have been a kind of dare or a challenge, a refusal to play by the rules, to accept the need to compartmentalize his life. And by the time, I think it's crucially related to the experience of the war. And that's one of the reasons I'm telling the story is because it's a great story, but also because what's applicable to Bill, I think, is applicable to lots of brigaders. That is the fact, for the war to have had meaning that they saw life had to change. It had to go beyond sterility, colourlessness, inauthenticity. Not only in terms of the political status quo, but also social convention. I'm crossing again. And I think our high school stage is this kind of crossover. I mean, Bill ever afterwards was a kind of searcher. He asked hard and remarkably modern questions about the politics of the personal, about the social construction of categories of public and private. For the rest, very rest of his life, it wasn't a very easy life afterwards. His chided refrain to friends would always be, you see how it's steady, but you see it's small. And after Spain, he was determined not to. I think this is a very significant impact of the war in the fighting, in my way, in Spain. His friendship with him got cool, but he didn't break. I suppose the story, the most significant of the story, is that it reminds us that in terms of all this border crossing, the border of gender and sexuality was one kind of border that the older left of the 1930s had much more difficulty crossing. You only have to look at what happened when Hutchins tried to sign up with the lorry driver in Spain to fight in the assist with the Liberal Brigade war effort. And in the end, she was cussed enough. She cut her way. But hers was an isolated victory. In general, women were only recruited to Spain to work at Oscar only, not that being a nurse wasn't important or dangerous, but in the sense it was, they were only able to be recruited in general in ways which were consonant with the conventional gender understanding of what women could do in those times. Hutchins also attempted to get in on the act with the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, which parachuted ex-brigaders and other kinds of shady characters, as Walsall used to call them, into Western Europe to fight with resistance movements. And she chose to sign up for this, of course, was kind of knocked back while on Germany and was absolutely spitting furious. But obviously there were limits and gender was really one of them. So that, what happened to all of this after this cosmopolitan spirit, this cultural hybridity in the post-Second World War order? Obviously after the defeat in Spain, many continental European brigaders go up, they pass from Catalonia when Catalonia falls in February 39, they pass to France, they pass to the punishment camps, labour battalions, they fight on after the fall of France in part of the resistance movement, and they fight on in the belief that the war that they're fighting in is a continuation of Spain, in inverted commas, the values they fought for in Spain. But of course the fact is, again, history is against them. The world order that emerges after 1945 also finds their plurality, their heterodoxy, their difference, once again to be surplus to requirements of the new political order, social order, East and West, not just, I'm going to talk about both. So again, it's back to that role of Kappa image, what became of that 19th century universe when we came in through and crossed every frontier, whatever we liked and not we liked. And the quote is from Louis Aragon, the French poet and populist activist who was a major figure on the cultural front that defended the Spanish Republic. And he posed the question in the mid-1960s and 1965 in a trilogy, it's a comment from his last novel trilogy. And obviously by 1965 that assessment of his was loaded with an acutely painful nostalgia which is derived from the knowledge of the depredations which the political cultures of Stalinism had brought on the utopian projects of the left. Stalinism is there, Stalinism wasn't one thing. And anyway, you still have to see Stalinism as a variant of something else which has been lurking in this paper. And what it is a variant of is, if you like, the rise of a more complex surveilling state. And it wasn't the rise of a more complex surveilling state is not something that's limited to Stalinism. And it's evident particularly after 1918, you see the way in which the increasing intensity of surveillance of political exiles abroad by police and intelligence agents of various states. Not that the state hadn't always policed potentially unruly exiles, of course they had, but before something's happening in the 1920s and 30s, you see subversive nationals are rapidly coming to be seen by a whole series of states in very similar ways to the way in which Hitler described European Jews as kind of Luftmensch, ruthless people who are untrustworthy, exotic cosmopolitans. And so increasingly, surplus to the requirements of homogenising states who want compliant standard subjects. So as the exiles cross borders, so with them go the agents of European states and political orders, Italian, German, Soviet, to discipline them, to return them, sometimes to kill them. So again, border crossing is always it's starting to inspire much greater levels of distrust and fear and watchfulness. I mean, what kind of states are doing this? Well, basically a lot of totalitarian states, the ones I've just cited. But also, of course, it's extended to the American state, McCarthy, depriving people of passports. Bill Alto was deprived of both his, I haven't told you why he had a disability pension, but he did. He was deprived of both his disability pension and his passport by the American state and forced back from Europe to America in 1952. So in the West, Second World War, international progressions, as I'm sure everybody here knows, were implicitly or explicitly viewed as reckless, subversive, politically untrustworthy, malcontent, unpatriotic, potentially traitorous, the antithesis of the settled, demobilized, compliant populations from which they were silenced and excluded in various ways. In the East, in spite of the apparent differences, things were startlingly similar for many veterans. In the countries of the Eastern Bloc, as it has emerged in 1949. The fight against fascism was, of course, the foundational myth of the new socialist order, and so that meant also the fight against fascism in Spain. But as a lot of sort of state products are run today, that narrative of anti-fascism, anti-fascist heroes, was very kind of controlled and reductive. Very many real international debaters didn't fit this requirement. They just didn't fit the kind of two-dimensional sort of the obsessive kind of surveilling of the they were called the Spanish fighters, the Spanishian Kämpfer. They were, in theory, they were the anti-fascist aristocracy of the DDR, of East Germany, but in reality they were super surveilled. They had to publish biographies for the general public identification, and these biographies were written and rewritten until they were right. You know, but obviously why it was nothing to do with what their lives were, it was to do with, you know, the needs of public consumption and identification. And it's a kind of death basis for realization, I suppose. They were kind of reinvented, they were reduced to becoming two-dimensional socialist realist heroes. And I thought that's another way of saying it, you know, it's different in terms of that, but it's kind of the same effect. Censorship just basically rendered their lives kind of, alien to themselves, if you like. I'm going to talk about some examples of this, but I haven't got time to, but I could talk about a few, but one, the most destructive one, the one which I really have to say something about, it led to this kind of editorialization, this kind of narrowing down, led to half a lifetime of limbo and marginalization for one very prickly and difficult German ex-international brigadier called Rudolf Michaelis. He was, in the words of another sort of Czech dissident exile, he had so many prisons behind him. He was an anarchist whose original profession had been as an archaeological restorer at the Berlin State Museum. His life was traduced by every state, every single state you could get to mention. First of all, Nazi preventive custody, gets out by the skin of his teeth because he knows somebody knows someone who knows Goering. Goes into exile in Spain in 1933. Fights in the war, one of the anarchist columns, gets caught up in the Barcelona Majors, is imprisoned in a stateless Spanish Republican state jail, gets out, takes Spanish citizenship, fights with the Spanish Republican army, goes into exile, fights in the French resistance, tries to cross back into Franco's Spain, is caught, is imprisoned, spends 5 years in Franco's jail being tortured. He is repatriated in 1946 to his family in Berlin. Where else could he have gone? He makes his peace of a sword. He makes peace of a sword with the new state order of East Germany, the DDR, which is emerging by 1949. He even goes as far as to join the new state civil party, the SED. He's cut dead by anarchist colleagues in the West because he does that. He's later expelled from the SED in 1951 because he's too politically heterodox. They get very worried, sort of, with it feeling vulnerable it doesn't suffer imprisonment. But obviously, in a sense, it's a kind of half, in a lot, but the video allowed him to make the material basis for a life, and it allowed him to kind of be part of a collective memory of what's playing in there, which was not absolutely a lie. It was reductive, but it wasn't absolutely a lie. And he's confined to the margins. His story is literally unrepresentable, unspeakable even, in any tradition. I mean, whether it's his memoirs were eventually published in the 1980s in West Germany under pseudonym, right? In the 80s, that's significant, very late on. And of course, in the East, of course, he's only in the very early, in East Germany, in Berlin, he's only in the late 1970s and 80s that he's able to speak about his experiences. What is his experience? His experience is the multiplicity of the anti-fascist tradition, and it's only possible to speak of those things very late on in sort of this semi non-official semi-public space for debate, which is beginning to appear in East Germany by the early 1970s. That was bad enough elsewhere in the East, of course. The whiff of cosmopolitanism that appeared to Spain was actually a death sentence, very literally. So many of those who were consumed in the trials and purges in Hungary in 1949, Czechoslovakia in 1952, had been to Spain. Being in Spain itself opened them up to being charged with being heard before, restless, subversive, politically untrustworthy, malcontents, unpatriotic, potentially traitorous, from a party description. In a sense, I can't go into the whole story of the trials in East Europe, but basically, one of the famous victims of the Czechoslovakian trials, the Slovensky trials in 1952, Arthur London published his account in the Telesero came out. His story, if you read it on trial, published in French in 1968, a couple of years later in English, it's absolutely amazing in how it emerges with crystal clarity, the link between border crossing and contamination. The state authorities were absolutely obsessed by what these were people who had been in the brigades, had often been in concentration camps, they'd been exiles from depending on where they'd come from, they'd been exiles in the interwar period. And there was a certain amount of spy mania around. In a sense, there is an echo of something else here as well, of kind of the fear of difference, of change, of complexity. Somehow these people challenge a state order that wants uniformity, homogeneity, and all this is expressed as contamination. It's a bit like the king's dead long with the king, that the Hitlerian universe is gone, but it lives on in this kind of fear of kind of plurality and contamination. That's really interesting, that link between anyone who'd been in Spain, anyone who'd been in concentration camps, in a sense was untrustworthy. I'm just wondering if you talk heterodox. It seems to me that what was lurking in all of this is not that far removed from the sort of narrative you get in the West, post-war Western policy of establishment, and in particular, I suppose, in the US, where in the post-1945 period, an army of social scientists are being deployed to find ways of stabilizing society, of closing things down, of closing down all that flux and social mobility that had been generated triggers by the enormous explosion that the Second World War meant. And obviously McCarthyism wasn't as direct and deadly as the East European trials, although of course it did cause deaths and it did cause suicides. But of course, the thing you have to remember is not that you can't bring it not to a direct comparison with East Europe, but state repression always takes its form according to local political culture. And as we well know, there's many more than one way of killing somebody without physically liquidating them, or doesn't really do that. You can kill people with making them totally unemployable, as happens in some cases, or making them unemployable in any way which remotely comes near to what they feel they are fitted to do by virtue of their talents, reducing people to poverty, making their lives unlivable, getting them thrown out of their homes repeatedly, indirectly breaking up their families and their very personal relationships. That is true, it's pretty hellish. I'm not going to labour here or exemplify the legal repressive practices of McCarthyism, because I'm sure many people in the room could tell me about them better than I can tell you. But I think one thing, in a sense, because of the themes of this paper, I wanted just to highlight is the kind of the psychology. natural displacements, dislocations of my experience can induce. For example, Mexico, which in some way provided a refuge, although I don't think a haven for persecuted American radicals, which is recounted in a really very good book published in 2001 called Gathering of Fugitives by a very diaper baby called Juana Arnold. It poses, I mean, she shows how Mexico was, in a sense, it posed lots of fundamental existential problems for, especially the cultural workers who were very large in that particular exile. Her account is absolutely honest about the pain and the personal cost in refusing to conform, of needing to refuse to conform, but nevertheless, it's crossing borders is a compulsion, but it's one that leads to pain and difficulty. And the writer Harold Fast, the son of a Russian Ukrainian migrant, who himself he served a prison sentence, a short prison sentence in 1947 as a member of the Lincoln Vets Spanish Refugee Relief Committee for refusing to reveal to the House Committee on American Activities the names and addresses of the donors of the Refugee Committee. And he wrote very luminously about the Lincolns, the Abraham Lincolns, when he's taking to Spain in a short story called Departures, which captures absolutely perfectly that central feeling that so many veterans had about, you know, anyone who'd been in Spain in solidarity role as a medical worker, a nurse, or indeed as a fighter, that they were burned by Spain. They were never, ever going to be the same again. They were never really going to fit ever anywhere again. And that's, in a sense, it's another kind of exile which goes along with the political and territorial. The fact that sort of Spain burned people and they never fitted ever again. And Fast has a superb autobiography which is published in 1990 called Being Red, which I recommend. It's absolutely brilliant, beautifully written book. And he relates an encounter with his friend, the screenwriter Albert Matz, who was one of the Hollywood Ten, one of the film workers indicted for contempt during the 1940s, returns to Hollywood. And Howard Fast encounters Albert Matz in Mexico, and Matz is so terrified by the potential effects of the draconian Communist Control Act of 1954 that he stays in Mexico, despite feeling completely culturally alienated there. He says, Mr. Howard Fast, I have no roots here. Our lives are our language. And he's been so seared by this experience of prison, being in prison, that he can't risk it again. He's saying, I have to live. I have to find love, I have books that I must write. And while that devastating experience is a long way from Europe's concentration camp universe, those words, I have to live, I have to find love, I have books that I must write, puts me very strongly in mind of the sentiments which were expressed by a Hungarian poet with the sentiments that are at the end of my little book on the Spanish Civil War. Miklos Radmoti, who was he wrote Republican Spain, the friends who died there in combat, the symbols of what made the fight still worthwhile. And he wrote these lines to General Grant of Beauty in July 1944 while he himself was imprisoned in a Nazi-controlled labour camp near Bor in Serbia, and only months before he was himself killed by Hungarian guards on the prisoner's force march in the wake of the retreating German army. And he says, among false rumours and worms, we live here with Frenchmen, Poles, loud Italians, heretic Serbs, nostalgic Jews, in the mountains. This feverish body, dismembered, but still living one life, waits for good news, for woman's sweet words, for a life both free and human. A life both free and human. I have to live, I have to find love, I have books that I must write. It seems to me a tremendous echo. Spain haunted them all because it was unlikely to haunt them all. It haunted them because it was a site of possibility of becoming. And that's why it haunts us still, because for all of the bleakness of its aftermath, it stands up that reminder of the possibility of becoming, of a journey without maths, of Machado's own reminder that the route does not exist, that we make that route by walking, that it to do so hurts, but it's also a necessity. It is a humane and a human imperative.
Thank you so much. Alan is quite amenable to taking questions, and he even coming up with an answer once in a while. Thank you for correcting me. I'll never forgive you, but yes.
Thank you. Obviously, you know, very nice talk and a lot of thought is gone into it. I didn't want to take issue with on two points. One at the beginning and one towards the end. So this idea that people who went to Spain were actually continuing some struggles in their home countries, you know, when they went to Spain. I have a lot of difficulty with that. You know, it seems to me that people develop their politics in various ways. You know, it might be through local struggles, but they, you know, so they develop a world view and this whole idea of internationalism, and they practice that by going to Spain or by doing other things. So it's not that somebody goes to Spain and is continuing some civil war that took place in some country or some other country. It's just that they have a certain politics. And so there are people in this country who fought against war in Vietnam, and they also fight against the invasion of Iraq. Now, it doesn't mean they're continuing their old fight. It's just that they have a certain politics, and they have a certain way of looking at the world. So
is that really saying something different to what I'm saying? I mean,
I think it came, at least it came across to me as if it wasn't that they had a certain analysis of Spain and the need to go and fight
more. Well, often many of them didn't know very much about what was actually going on in Spain. I mean, you have it. The guy says, "I'm going to pledge my sister." He's not a
Germans.
So how do you interpret that other than as seeing a connection?
Yes. I mean, you're a historian, so I can't. This is my view of at least contemporary.
description of veterans as being, you know, seen as subversive in both the East and the West, that's what we're as being heterodox and that being, you know, totally unacceptable to the various roles of the state, you know, very, very powerful. And just a comment in it, and it's easy to sort of, I mean, the parallels are very far from being exact, and obviously the experiences of the veterans were much more intense. But I was just struck as you were describing it, obviously a lot of the ways of looking at the world were very similar to political radicals in the 60s. And it's just intriguing, that during all this craziness that's going on right now around Bill Ayers, is that there isn't any space that, you know, Obama's position is, well, you know, it was 40 years ago on several stuff, and I had nothing to do with it, and all this kind of stuff. And that's sort of the left of the mainstream debate. And there isn't any space except on the left for people to say, yeah, right, exactly. You know, people were doing what needed to be done. There were reasons for it. There were reasons that people were rebelling and so forth. And it's just interesting to see, you know, 30, 40 years later, how tightly that space has closed so that that has to be seen as illegitimate by all of mainstream factors. I read was Celine, and it's absolutely the greatest, the opposite racist chauvinist. And he doesn't accuse the partisans and the resistance. He always picks out their non French origins when he can find it. But I want you to you consider that, and I think this is an arrogance, you consider that type of position arrested development. And if you do consider it that, what was the point when people who are, let's say, racially, chauvinistically, nationalistically, purity people, what was the moment in history when they should have grown out of that and gone in another direction? Because it seems to me that this connected, it has its authenticity. Well, there will be people who feel that way. Right? And it shouldn't be arrogant with the sense that the rest of the world is going to grow up. They shouldn't feel that way about their clock.
The reality is that having that kind of worldview is backward, is my point. So I think we shouldn't, I think we need to criticize it.
I want to thank you for your talk. I always enjoy reading your works, and it's a great pleasure to see you in person. I want to get a sense from you as to how you've seen the writing of the history of the Spanish Civil War in general in the past 20 years, and how it's taken form, not only in Europe and in different countries of Europe, but in Spain and Germany. And I was impressed with the localized histories, like pouring out everywhere on all aspects of the Spanish Civil War. I was in Madrid for a week, and I discovered the phenomenon of reactors, which is very similar to our kind of, you know, I'm thinking of the great Pulitzer Prize model of either a book in this country to focus on the act about Iran, but very different in Spain. And I just wonder what kind of thoughts you have about that in terms of the history of writing. Also, you know, we've had the revelations since last night of all the, you know, of all the different documents that have come out. I know some of them are here in New York. All that mixture of writing that's coming out, what do you make of it all?
That's an answer that's a 3 hours worth, but I mean, in general, I mean, the last 30 years, I suppose, 30, 40 years now, really, that the president has just through your spending is written by finance, you know, we all, you know, country piece of brains of sound, but that is the idea of covering, particularly that outpouring of words that liberalism has been particularly about repression, it's been about, you know, uncovering, if you like, the you know, the mass murder on which Franco was in the space. So it is, it's the, you know, well, you must, you know, you've been this thing, you know, all about the recuperation of historical memory, the clearing of mass graves, the naming of the extrajudicially disappearing, as we know, the 30,000 people, you know, plus the whole shebang. I mean, that's what the whole European, kind of in-house Spanish history that started in, you know, surely, or 1980, should we say, was a lot about that. There's a lot of stories who are basically doing that work, or basically, you know, telling the grassroots story of Franco. He also was a corrective to, you know, Spanish democracy returns in 1975, and there is a pact of silence, and the kind of, there's an agreement between the, you know, kind of the enlightenment with the Francoism and the democratic interlocutors, but they will not talk about the past. So, of course, there won't be the equivalent to the Stasi archives at, we won't know who the torturers were. Those who did dire things in the basements of police stations will be protected from prosecution. There won't even be a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. People who were definitely given some to their relatives or who don't know where grandfather was, nothing will happen. You know, something will just be a veil covered over that. What local what historians have done in the last 25 to 30 years is tell that story, you know, from cemetery lists, from talking to people, they have reconstructed the story of that mass killing. Obviously there's lots of other history, but I mean, it's interesting what is the exploding in Spanish historiography over the last 30 years. It's about the 1930s, it's about the Civil War.
Did you follow them into life afterwards? Did they marry? Did they have children? What kind of children? How were they raised? This is very important history.
Maybe it's your next book.
Anybody read about that?
Well, your paper was wonderful, thank you. And as the son one of five siblings of an Irish volunteer who fought in Spain for 18 months, I recognize fully the psychopolitical profile that you've developed of in the profile of volunteers, and I recognize it as having overshadowed my entire childhood. And in addition to periodic occasions when my mother had to remove with warm water, iodine, and tweezers fragments from that had percolated to the surface of his person. And so I think it was a wonderful paper you gave, and it was terrific. And I think the other four are okay as well. Just one other thing, we have some of Philip's books for sale in the back. We have a little reception for you. Please stick around and keep talking, but we'll need a little time to swallow. Okay. Thanks for coming so much.